Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
For conformity is the jailer of freedom and the enemy of growth.
John F. Kennedy, in a speech to the UN General Assembly, September 1961. And that's always been a quintessentially American point of view, you know, that it's the maverick, the loner who gets things done. To conform is weak, easy, and dangerous. But perhaps we're starting to rethink our notion of conformity and maybe even see the benefits of just, well, fitting in. David Barabee is a science writer and author of the book Us and Them, Understanding Your Tribal Mind, which will be out in paperback this summer from the University of Chicago Press. He also had a piece in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine called The Case for Fitting In. Maybe you saw it. David, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
And you began your article with, of all people, Eliot Spitzer.
Yes, indeed, because I was struck by how many people had said that his behavior was such an inconsistent and surprising thing, the prosecutor who was violating the law and so on and so forth. And it seemed to me that in his willingness to say, I'm going to do what I see myself doing without worrying about what others expect, that was perfectly consistent between the State House and the Emperor's Club.
So I think the whole Spitzer story points up the fine line that we have in our value system between when we like individuality and when we don't, right?
Right.
So Spitzer, the lone wolf as prosecutor,
yep,
who came from this moneyed background, who refused to fit in,
right,
with the Wall Street types and the,
yep,
big insurance companies and went after them instead,
yep,
he was a hero for,
right,
that.
Right.
But then when he didn't fit in with the lawmakers in Albany, then he was a lone wolf and that was bad.
Right, exactly. I mean, we have a very strong prejudice in favor of the person who stands up and says, I won't play along, I like to rock the boat, I'm a maverick. And it's rhetoric that we like, no matter what our political views. I mean, there are people who like John McCain for that. There are people who like Barack Obama for that, who says he won't do the okey-doke. It's not about your politics. It's about a kind of a style that we like to see. And the plain fact of the matter is, I think it makes us maybe a little prone to people who are willing to ignore traditions and laws of banking and give us a financial crisis, or willing to ignore diplomacy and their own military and put us in Iraq.
And we see in the presidential race, John McCain, one of his best qualities to his supporters is the fact that he's a maverick,
right?
Right? Obama trying to position himself, yeah, as postpartisan, not quite fitting in,
yeah,
to,
yeah,
his party,
yeah,
you know, although that cuts both ways in a primary.
Yeah.
And I guess there's an obvious appeal, in the U.S. at least, to not fitting in. And in your piece, you trace the roots of this to post-World War II social scientists,
yeah,
who were reacting against the rise of Nazism.
Right. And I think there was also an element of Cold War anxiety in that, too. I mean, the Adorno...
Communism, and socialism.
Exactly. The idea was that people worried about brainwashing and... I think became obsessed with the idea that people could do stuff that we didn't want to imagine a human being doing. So why did they do that? Why did they do that in such great numbers? And so people did these interesting experiments, the famous Stanley Milgram experiment, where people think they're giving increasingly high electric shocks to someone and being told it's no problem, go ahead, you have no choice, by someone in a white coat. So they go way past the thing that's clearly labeled danger. That was an example of a kind of work in which people presumed that what you want is the normal state, the good state, is the individual atom who thinks this is what to do, I know how to behave, and then is somehow pushed or polluted or deformed by their sense of what they have to do to get along with other people.
Right. But one other way to look at it in the World War II context is that conformity was exactly the thing that brought Americans together by war bonds, sacrifice,
right,
for the cause,
right,
the whole thing.
Exactly. I mean, it's one of these things that people think is a simple value that is, in fact, a very complex one, because it's a sort of we like it when it supports when it is in conjunction with something that we support. Teamwork, getting along. As I mentioned in the piece, there is no way to have a society without trust. And trust is about if the man is wearing a police uniform or woman is wearing a police uniform and says, don't go down this street, you don't say, I'm going to figure it out for myself. You say, well, it's the police. They know what they're talking about. You have to have a certain amount of that. We like that when we agree with what's going on in the as a result. And when we don't like it, we have this other way of seeing it. But whether or not we like it, the fact of the matter is getting along in society is a balancing act between your own drives and perceptions and what other people need from you and expect of you. And we all do it, whether we want to say that we don't.
Listeners, we have a few minutes for calls on this. If you want to give us your take on conformity in your life individually, do you feel a tension between conformity and nonconformity, individuality and community? How do you find a balance between being your own person and also fitting into society? 212-433-WNYC, or you could talk about it at the social level, the political level, even the international or national identity level, 212-433-9692. And really both, I don't know if you want to say political parties or maybe, you know, liberal and conservative value systems in the United States have their individualist streaks and have their communitarian streaks.
Absolutely.
So on the communitarian side, liberals might be more inclined to say, well, the people, as expressed through the government, should spend more money to help lift up the poor or whatever
sure.
that might be. Conservatives might say, well, we should be more communitarian and in what they might call family values.
Sure. I mean, I think liberals will say that you should tolerate domestic nonconformity. It's fine for Heather to have two mommies, but she can't have school vouchers. Meanwhile, conservatives say, why not experiment? Why throw out the regulations from the SEC, the traditions of banking and so on? Why do we need to do that? But of course, when you go home, it's got to be the nuclear family. So it's really a matter of whose ox is being gored. You can slice this both ways ideologically.
Gene in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gene.
Hi there, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that you need to add another layer to the discussion, which is there's a difference between conformity and solidarity. One is usually based on principle, the solidarity, and conformity is often you act in a way that will not call attention to yourself, that you're trying not to stand out, not to rock the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very important because some people will act in a principled way in most situations, even if acting that way might cause them to be out of sync with most other people around them who are acting in an unprincipled way. Whereas in terms of solidarity, you may be a member of a union, and you're acting in solidarity with other people in your circumstances because you want to, emphasize a certain set of values and
right, or accomplish some goals. It's a great question. Is every act of solidarity an act of conformity?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really nice question, and I think it might be useful to distinguish between conformity, quote unquote, that serves only you, that makes your life easier, that causes you to be able to go home and go to sleep, versus conformity, quote unquote, that is actually rather difficult for you, but that serves some purpose. Or you could do it the other way around. You could say nonconformity that is self-serving is perhaps not so desirable, and nonconformity that is actually difficult for the person. But that involves saying this is wrong, no matter what people say, no matter what consequences. Is a good thing. I mean, I think the key point here is that we've been using this word for the last 40 years that is kind of not a great word to describe something very complicated and interesting about our lives.
Let me get a couple of callers in before we run out of time. Alice in Brooklyn wants to talk about nonconformity and the art world, and then Drew in Manhattan will get to you on the corporate world. Let's do art first. Alice, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. Well, the interesting thing to me that I felt for many years is that the current art world claims to be all about nonconformity. That
yep.
you look at what's going on in the biennials now, you look at the various art fairs that have been around town this weekend, and everyone's saying, I'm different, I'm different, but they're all different in kind of the same way. And I am an artist, and I don't conform to what is in right now. And I see that there are a lot of artists who whose work is, in my mind, much more spiritual, soul-based, has a lot of depth to it, takes a lot of time to look at. It has to. It's not quick. It's not fast. You can't write easily about it. It's very visual. And all of that is work that, in a sense, comes out of the past, but is still very present. And that work does not conform. And it doesn't get around. You never see it. You never read about it. But it's very serious work. And the work that does conform is the work that's much easier to comprehend, that is fun, that has some kind of social commentary that I think would be great in a textbook about, you know, politics or the social events of the time.
Even though that would have been considered nonconformist work once upon a time.
Well, at this point, I think it's a kind of academic avant-gardism. I think that you can look at kind of historically what was at one time new art.
Right. Now it's like that's the way you have to do art as you see it. And Drew in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Drew.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been in sort of marketing and communications in New York for a little over 20 years. And it's interesting that my nonconformist behavior was much more action-oriented but not idea-oriented in the beginning of my career. But as I've sort of moved up into executive levels, my nonconformist is more based in ideas and not necessarily in implementation any longer, which is sort of an evolution. And I'd spend a lot of time sort of managing the perception of my being sort of different as opposed to the actions that I take in implementing down through the corporate levels.
So, in other words, in the corporate world, you're always being told to think outside the box, but once you get outside the box, then you're ostracized.
Well, it's difficult to implement entirely outside the box because there's a reason why there's a chain of command. But the ideas themselves are the things that are the most interesting to traffic in with respect to being different.
Thank you very much. So bottom line here, are you advocating something in your article or are you just reporting on the tension between conformity and nonconformity?
I guess I'm advocating reporting that this that in psychology, which gave us this idea that people are sheep, and we should find that one Howard Roark guy outside the box, and he's always or she's always going to be right.
Someone on our comments page writes, "We can't resist the cool hand, Luke."
Right, exactly. I'm always amused by the signs that say, you know, the ad campaigns for things like this, like you don't drive the car everyone else drives, buy our car, or think different. Of course, millions of people are then thinking different to buy the product. So there's this allure of the idea that we all have to be mavericks, that's innately superior, and it's about this very simple idea of either you're knuckling under or you're being yourself. And I think we have to recognize we're all doing a balancing act and see life the way it really is.
Can you give me 15 seconds on whether you think this is particularly American?
I think the rhetoric that says mavericks are always right is particularly American, but I think the tension between get along and stand up for yourself is universal.
David Berube, science writer, author of the book Us and Them, Understanding Your Tribal Mind, and The Case for Fitting in the New York Times Magazine this week. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Let me be by myself in the evening breeze and listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please.